In a nutshell, this morning's message is summed up in the last few words that you've just sung. What a cost. What a cost. In the story that Jesus tells of the son being welcomed back by the father, there is no mention of the shame the father would have taken on by running through the village to welcome the son. There's no mention of how radical that is, but that would have been understood by the Jewish ears. Why is the dad running? Men didn't run. Senior men didn't run. Why is the dad embracing the son publicly and falling on his neck and kissing him and kissing him? Why is he doing that? Such affection was not normally displayed in public. And how could he possibly reinstate this filthy rebel back into home and clearly declare, son? That's what he is. He's my son. And the parallel is just as astounding. How is it that God, frankly, can take people like me or like you and dare to say the words, you are my children? I don't deserve that. You don't deserve that. But God's word is unashamed to call certain people children of God. Okay? What I want to look at this morning is what it cost God to enable him to say that. What it cost God to enable him to fling wide open his arms and welcome people like you and me. The danger is great. Sometimes we can think it's just God's job to forgive. That's what he does. That's what he promises. That's his job. And the danger of that is we assume that it's easy. It's cheap. And so we can afford then to take it or leave it. We can afford, even if we take it, to treat it as something of lower value than it is. But this psalm is one of many portions of the Bible that helps us, that arrests us, and hopefully stops the rot of that kind of attitude. It was not easy for God to do everything he could to make us friends with him, to make us children of God. It is not easy. It was not cheap that his love was given and bestowed upon people like you and me. This psalm comes in two parts. It's like a bad football match. It's a game of two halves, and the halfway mark is just the tail end of verse 21. The first half talks about the depths to which someone experiences an awful time. The depths to which someone experiences an awful time. Death is hot on the heels of this character in Psalm 22. We'll look at that in more detail. But after verse 21, you see that line that sort of stands on its own in verse 21? You see what it says? It says, you have answered me. After that line, things change. The sun comes out and shines. This man who's on his own is suddenly with people. This character who is desolate is now full of delight. And this psalm would have been read by people who were looking around, the first readers of this psalm, read by people who were looking around their nation, the nation of Israel, and it is far from what it ought to be. It is returned from exile, it was sent into exile because they were worshipping other gods. But God in his mercy returned the people to the place and his intention to bless. But it's not quite looking like what he promised. He promised grand things, great things. He promised a king who would reign forever and all the people would be blessed. And as they look around, well, it's not quite that. It's a fair bit short. And this psalm is one of many that would encourage people, even in tough times, even in disappointing times, to look up and trust that God knew what he was doing and he was able to hold on to his people. And it's no surprise. You know what comes after Psalm 22? Psalm 23. It's no surprise. As we look to God to hold on through tough times, we can enjoy this reflective, delightful experience of God providing everything we need. And that was the thrust of the first readers. That's what they would have understood. There are depths in this world, but there's a declaration, an acknowledgement that God is God and he will rescue his people. It reminds me of the story of Corrie ten Boom. Corrie ten Boom was brought into her and her family, her and her sister in particular, brought into a concentration camp during the war called Ravensbrück. And they had a horrible time there. Corrie made it out alive. Her sister did not. And as her sister viewed death not many days away, she said to Corrie, her sister, she said, "When you get out of here, tell people, no matter how deep the pit is, God is deeper still." Okay? That's what the psalm teaches. No matter how deep the pit is, God is deeper. No matter how bleak the situation, God is greater and will bring light and truth and hope into it and change situations. But there's a danger with this psalm. And the danger with this psalm is that we think that David has experienced tough times and God has raised him up. And therefore we will experience tough times and God will raise us up. This psalm is like a new blazer for school. Some of you are thinking towards getting new uniforms for your children. And as parents, you want to save money. So you're going to get a blazer that's going to fit for the next 6 years, aren't you? Okay? All right. I'll just tuck it up and we'll just let out a little bit. Okay? So your child goes to school, whether it's a jumper, a cardigan, a blazer, whatever it is. And you know at this time, if you buy it this time of the summer, they're going to grow between now and the start of September, and then by next Easter they're going to grow again. How much they're going to grow, you have no idea, so you give yourself plenty of room for your son or your daughter to grow. And your child goes to school, the consequence is your child goes to school on the first day with everything. It's just far too big. A school bag they could fit into. A blazer you could fit the whole family into. A jumper that looks like it's been washed out of shape, but actually it's brand new. Okay? It's all just too big for the child. Now, sooner or later, the child will grow into that uniform if they don't destroy it before then. Okay? This psalm is like a big blazer. It looks like David's wearing it, but there's no way on earth he's going to grow into this. There's no way he grows to fill this out. His experience, as far as we know, he never had his, verse 16, he never had his hands and his feet pierced. He never had his clothes played for in a game of lot. These things are not about David. Somebody else has to fill this blazer. Someone else has to fill these truths. And it's not David, but it is someone in David's line, as the Bible teaches us. It's one of David's descendants. The descendant that's laid in a manger. He'll fill this blazer. He'll fill these truths. These things will be true of him. The descendant who'll train as a carpenter. These things will be true of him. The descendant who will occupy a cross. These things will be true of him. The descendant who empties the tomb. These things are true of him. And only him. And there's a term for a psalm like this. It's called a messianic psalm. It can only be fully true of the Messiah, Jesus. Okay? And so we're going to look at this psalm through the experience of Jesus. The reason? So that you get a little glimpse of the shuddering cost to God that he could call you and me his children. Okay? The first thing we see is there is a long-term plan. Psalm 22 was written 1,000 years before Jesus. And yet there are things that are in it that are only true of Jesus. It is about him. 1,000 years, what's God doing? He's getting his people ready for someone who will wear this blazer, someone who will fill out these truths. You getting ready for your summer holidays? When did you book? Some of you haven't booked yet, have you? Some of you booked a few weeks ago. Some of you booked a few months ago. Some of you knew what you were doing this summer, possibly even 2 years ago. Okay? Did you plan 10 years ago for this summer? Probably not. God was planning, the Bible tells us, not just 1,000 years before Christ came. He was planning from eternity that Christ would come. There's a fiction book in our house that gets read from time to time about a little girl called Sophie. Sophie's going to be a farmer. Okay, she's 4 years old at the time of the story. And Sophie tells everybody she knows that she's going to be a farmer. She knows the animals she's going to have. She knows the staff she's going to have. She's picked a little boy, poor fella, to be a farmhand. And she bosses him around like no one's business. She's going to be a farmer. She's going to have it all her way. And one relative believes in her and has given her some money. At the age of 4, she's got £5.47 to build her farm. Okay? And as you read the story and get to know her character, there's no doubt that this little Sophie is going to be a farmer. She's going to make it because she's planning from day one all the way through her life. And as we read the Old Testament, there's a sense in which that sort of sentiment is expressed. God is getting ready. There is no way. There is no way he's not going to be rescuer. There is no way he's going to fail. And God is getting ready. Not he's getting ready, but he's getting us ready. As we read through. So when Jesus comes, he fills out, not just this psalm, but he fills out all the promises, all the prophecies. If you get ready for someone's birthday, last minute, that can happen, can't it? If you get ready for someone's birthday months in advance, that tells you at least that you care for the person greatly, doesn't it? It means that that person's important to you. God is getting ready, getting us ready, because he wants us to know that our rescue, for that is what we need, our rescue is important to God. There's a long-term plan. And Jesus is plan A. He hasn't taken the Old Testament and tried different things with his people who won't listen and won't love and won't follow. And then he sends Jesus as a last gasp option. Jesus' plan A has always been intentioned. I would encourage you, as you read about Jesus, as you think about Jesus, to view him as God's highest, his best, given for you, that you may know him. So there's this long-term plan that Jesus fulfills throughout Scripture and throughout history. But it's not just that a plan is in place. It's actually that these experiences are lived through by Jesus. On the cross, Jesus takes that first line of Psalm 22. Did that sound familiar when Steve read it earlier? My God, why have you forsaken me? That's one of the cries from the cross of Jesus. He's making this psalm his. And what I suggest to you is this. The depths in the declaration, the two parts, he's owning. He's owning the depths. I'm going to experience this. What David wrote about, the depths to which he went, I'm going to experience that, but I'm also going to experience the delightful uplifting and the declaration. I'm going to experience that. Now that's important because when we hear Jesus cry, my God, why have you forsaken me on the cross? None of us feel like smiling, do we? It's not a happy moment in history. But I suggest you it should be happier than it often is. Because Jesus is not just saying, God, it feels like you've forsaken me. In referring to this psalm, he's acknowledging that things are really bad. There is a depth to his experience that no one else has known. He's lived through the, living through the depths of verses 1 to 21, but he's doing so expectantly. He's doing so knowing that Psalm 21 finishes on a high, finishes well. And as he experiences that, Jesus, he knows that he will be vindicated. He knows he will be physically raised and spiritually glorified. It's a wonderful reference to a wonderful psalm. Let's look at the depths together. This lived through experience. The first few verses, verses 1 to 5, or if you like a little summary. Forsaken, my God, why have you forsaken me? And yet, that's not the whole story, is it? Forsaken, verses 1 and 2, yet God is seen as holy and has been trusted by the people of God. Verses 3, 4 and 5. You see verse 4? Our fathers trusted in you. They trusted and you delivered them. Here is Jesus knowing what it is to feel forsaken by God and yet knowing that God is faithful. Let's just see over some of those words in verses 1 and 2. Bearing in mind that these are the experiences, words that describe the experiences of Jesus. My God, why have you forsaken you? Why are you so far from helping me? And the words, and from the words of my groaning, oh my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear. And in the night season, and I'm not silent. Have you ever felt there's no one there to listen? Now, sometimes that's not too bad. Sometimes you're glad of peace and quiet. But when you want to talk, nobody there to listen is painful, isn't it? But when you're going through hard times, not just want to talk, but going through hard times and you want to talk, having nobody there, it's almost crushing. And here is Jesus, isolated, alone, feeling forsaken. And yet there's a memory. But you are holy. You are different. You are unique. And he remembers that through the history of God's people, God has always delivered. Verse 5 finishes, they were not ashamed. They were not left embarrassed in front of other people. Like orphans. Ashamed because they're not cared for or loved. No, that's not the experience at all. There is this pattern in this forsaken yet faithful. Fiercely opposed. This moves on to the second part of the first half. Fiercely opposed. Yet hopeful. Did it strike you as that passage was read, how ugly the scene is? It looks like a wild zoo has been let loose and there's only one person in the zoo caught, stranded, and they're being battered and bruised and bashed. You see verse 12. Many bulls have surrounded me. Strong bulls of Bashan. Bashan was a very fertile land. The bulls were as a result very strong. Strong bulls have encircled me. They gape at me with their mouths like a raging and roaring lion. The description then moves on from what's around them to what's within. Verse 14. Poured out like water. My bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. and my tongue clings to my jaws. You have brought me to the dust of death. We had a busy day as a family yesterday. We went from a school fair to a friend's barbecue. And in between, our son flagged to the point where I had he had to crawl from one room to another room to get what he needed to go to the barbecue. His energy was so low. But when we arrived at the barbecue, there was football being played. Up and away. He's fine. Energy back. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. Sometimes we know what it is to feel weak and yet revived. But do you know how far this character is going? Do you know how far Jesus is going in his experience? Verse 15, last line. You've brought me to the dust of death. This is not a quick revival job. This experience of being surrounded and circled, but also within, the challenge within, sounds gruesome. You see what he says in verse 6? See what it says about how other people treat him. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men, despised by all the people. All those who see me ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They pull faces, mimicking the anguished face of Jesus. They ridicule me. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted in the Lord. Let him rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Those words were said to Jesus on the cross. People looked. They mimicked his face. And they laughed. He trusted in God. Let God save him then. And even though, verses 9, 10, 11, even though he knows God has been with him and never far away, the experience continues. Verse 16, dogs have surrounded me. Congregation of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I'm told that the piercing of hands and feet at this time in history, David's time, was unknown. They didn't know it as a form of torture. They didn't know it as a form of execution. But God's Spirit inspires David to write that so that Christ fills out that truth and owns it for himself. His hands and his feet are pierced. It doesn't take much imagination, does it, for verse 17. If you're on a cross, arms stretched out, battered and bruised. It doesn't take much imagination. I can count all my bones. They look and they stare. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. It's as if the little game for the clothes down at his feet are just a taunt. You can do nothing. This is the last thing you've got in this earth. And we're just going to play a game for it. It's a taunt. It's another way of mocking, of ridiculing. Look at what you've done has got you. And look at your worldly possessions. We're just playing for them now. We're playing for them. And this is the experience that Jesus knew. Fiercely opposed. Brought to the dust of death. And yet notice this, before he gets to the end of verse 21, he's still looking to God. He's still trusting. But you, O Lord, do not be far from me. O my strength, hasten to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dog. Save me from the lion's mouth and the horn of the wild oxen. And then it all changes. David, as he writes, anticipates a rescue from death. Jesus, as he fills out these truths, experiences death. And this psalm of rescue from death becomes a rescue from the grave when Jesus lives it out. There's this glorious then, second part, verses 22 on through to the end. There's this glorious, delightful celebration of what God has done, verse 31, last line. That he has done this. There's this wonderful declaration. I'm not going to go through that last part bit by bit. But what I want you to see is this. Once he who was forsaken is now in company. Once he who is isolated is now with people. Do you see that? I will declare your name to my brethren. He's with people now. He's in a gathering of people. Once he who was despised now knows joy. Once he was discouraged now realizes, verse 24, that God doesn't despise or abhor the afflicted. Once he was captive of many, is now free to serve. And this is a picture of the life of Jesus after the resurrection, declaring to God and to God's people through the power of his Spirit the victory that he has secured. The victory through which we stand. Do you see how far ranging it is? Verse 22, I will declare your name to my brethren. The Jews, the Jewish people, God's people would hear of this. But it's not limited to them. Verse 27, all the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nations. That's everybody. So big and so grand is what Jesus has done. Will be known and delighted in. It's for not just everybody, but it's for the rich and the poor. Do you see that in verse 26? The poor shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him will praise the Lord. But it's not just the poor, it's the prosperous as well. Verse 29, the prosperous of the earth shall eat and worship too. Everybody. Jew and non-Jew, rich and poor. Do you know, we were looking last week, last Sunday even, there are no boundaries. This message is for everybody. So that's the pattern. There's this depths, and then this declaration, this horrific experience, and then this glorious exaltation. Let's just ponder for a moment. If Jesus had to go through those depths to deal with my sin and yours, how serious is your sin? We can think funny things if we're left our own devices. We can think that actually we can, talking to the children, we can do it ourselves. Very simply, if we could do it ourselves, why would God send Jesus to experience stuff like this? Why would he do that if you're okay without him? That's nonsense. Absolute nonsense. You see? If our sin breaks us from God, God's the one who has to do the chasing, the pursuing, and the winning us back. Our sin is serious. How deep do you think God's love is? It's one thing to see how serious our sin is, and I hope there's a little glimpse of that this morning, but how deep do you think God's love is? To intentionally plan that his son would come and take this experience for you and for me. How deep does he love? Loving relationships in this world are characterized by self-sacrifice, aren't they? Parents for children, loving siblings for other siblings. Happens occasionally, doesn't it? Children for parents. We get the idea of self-sacrifice, but there are limits, aren't there? We draw the line sometimes, don't we? Enough's enough. I can only help you a little bit, not a lot. But here God steps in and does everything in the death of his son. How deep then must his love be? I hope you were singing when we were singing with the children. For God so loved the world. It's not a cold, calculated move. This experience of Jesus is driven by a deep love for people like you and me. If my sin deserves this kind of experience, if God's love is so deep that he would do that, how am I fixed if I don't receive Christ's death on my behalf? How am I fixed if I don't receive Christ's death on my behalf? I am saying no to God's love and I'm holding on to my sin. Do you see? And anybody in that situation is in eternal trouble. To turn our back on God's love as revealed through Jesus Christ, to hold on to our sin rather than be embraced and forgiven by him. We are in trouble. Without Jesus Christ, we are in trouble. But you need not be without Christ. You need not be without Jesus. For he has come. He has filled out the truth of these words. He has died. He has risen. And he shares the message by the power of Spirit to all. Let's imagine you go on a summer holiday and you were a little bit giddy when you booked it. So you wanted an early start. You booked a 7 o'clock flight. The penny's just dropped a few days ago. If you're leaving at 7, you've got to be at the airport at 5. If you're going to be at the airport at 5, you've got to get up at 4. Okay? And you realise, this is bad news. So the alarm gets set for 4 o'clock. You go to bed. No one goes to bed early before a holiday, do they? Last minute packing, you go to bed after midnight. The alarm goes off. That is information. It is time to get up. Get up. It's 4 o'clock. But that's not all you need. You need motivation. Don't you? What's the motivation? I want to go on holiday. That's the motivation, isn't it? I want to go on holiday. And you hope that's strong enough to get you out of your warm bed and to go through the next few hours and get it. I want to go. That's the motivation. The gospel is filled with two of those, both of those. Information. Jesus has died for sin, your sin. That's the information. Without his death, this experience that he experienced would be yours in the right judgment of God. That's the information. The motivation to come and receive that is that Jesus has taken all of that by himself in love, in a deliberate act, that you may know him and be with him. And when we understand that, and when God helps us to understand that, we find ourselves willing and able to say, I want him. I want that death to be for me. Motivation. I want to receive what he's giving. It's not enough, friend, just to know what God has said. And if you find yourself this morning not sure of where you stand with God, can I urge you? He's not in the habit of playing hide and seek. Ask him, Lord, from where I am now, until I am yours and I know I am yours, take me on. Grant to me the understanding of your love. Grant to me the motivation to receive. Help me. Don't leave me alone. Until I'm yours. There's information today. And with God working in our hearts, there is motivation to receive. Christ has died so that you and I could be called sons. Don't dare take it lightly. And don't dare just leave it there. Ask him to help you to live in the light of it, to receive it, to know it, and to enjoy him forever.